Welcome to Newsworthy with Norrisworthy. Get ready for some awesome.
Welcome back to the show, friends. Today we have returning to the show our good friend, Dr. Richard Beck. How are you, Richard?
I'm good. Good to be back on the show.
Well, we are glad to have you back on. We have a lot of important things to talk about today. A lot of important things. None more pressing than the first issue on the docket. You cut your hair. What happened? Why did you cut your hair?
I don't want to reveal it. It's too embarrassing.
Well, Richard, we're all friends here. This is really a safe place to practice honesty.
Okay. Well, to be totally honest with you, when you get to be about my age, and so it was kind of thinning at the top, and my bangs were thinning a little bit, and so it was getting really long. It was kind of getting a little straggly. My wife just didn't like hanging out with a guy who looked homeless all the time.
Oh.
So I had kind of a rough little look there. And so, I think it would be manageable if I wouldn't get my hair cut more often. But I would just let it go. I had a biannual haircut. I got my hair cut every like 6 months. So.
Wow. But now you're going to have to cut it a whole lot if you're going to keep it short.
Exactly. I think, you know what, I haven't told my wife this yet, but I think I'm going to grow it back out again.
Yes,
you
know? Yes.
People just like it long, so
yes, we do.
I don't know.
We so. Do. If I remember correctly, it's been long for quite a while, hasn't it?
Yeah, it has been. I took some students to Germany, and my hair used to be real short. I used to just buzz it off.
Yeah.
Just get a razor and set it on one and just cut it off. And but I went to Germany, and I didn't want to carry clippers with me. And so just let it grow out that month we were over there, and I came back to the States and just let it keep growing. I think it was like 7-8 years ago.
Yeah, because when I was an undergrad at ACU, and I didn't really know you. Obviously, you office right next to my dad, but I don't remember your hair being long back then.
No.
What I do remember is you would ride your bike to work.
I still do that.
Okay, good. At least you didn't completely sell out. I mean, the haircut,
no.
It's one step, but I'm glad you're on your bike still.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to, the trouble with the hair is, I don't want to get to look to be like some sort of aging hippie when I'm like 7 years old with like.
What's wrong with that? There's nothing
long
wrong with
hair.
That.
Yeah. That's true.
You're a psychologist. That's true. Yeah. It's kind of in your job description.
That's right. So. So I think I got so much feedback when I got it cut. Some people like it. But a lot of people are like, no, man, I missed it. It's long hair. It's not the same, And now I don't look like any publicity photos, So,
Before your next book gets out, we're going to have to grow it out so that, you match your publicity photos. That's a good reason right there.
That's all right, yeah.
How was the C21? Is it the name of the conference you're at in Phoenix?
Oh, yeah, it was amazing. I mean, it was really, though, intense.
Really?
Because you have these 21 amazing speakers, and then you have, really talented attendees doing 21-7 talks, where, like, 21 people talk for 7 minutes. And so you have these really kind of high-powered speakers really condensing everything down to 21 minutes, and they come, like, four or five in a session. And so you're completely blown away by somebody.
Who were some of the people out there that we would know?
Zach was out there. Zach Lynn was out there. Melton, from Momastery, Dan Cortez, Ephraim Smith, Chris Say, Kristen Houghton. I mean, Brian McLaren, just Born Winner, Tana Nyquist, and just some, amazing people. And so they kind of blow your hair back, and then as you were trying to process what you'd heard, another person would get up in 21 minutes, hit you again. So it became very intense. I've never experienced anything quite like it. Because usually when you go to a conference, there might be like one big headliner, and they might speak once or twice. But when you have 21 headliners doing very intense, almost TED Talk-like sessions, it's a bit much to process.
So it's like one right after the other, so you don't really have time to process it and make sense of what you just heard, you get to go right to the next one?
Right. Yeah. Well, in any given session, you might have like five of these speakers. And so, yeah, you get it with five, and then there might be a break, and then you hear the shorter 7-minute talk from audience members, and theirs were just as powerful as anybody else's.
What did our friend Zach Lynn talk about? I'm assuming Phil Collins was involved in some way.
You know, that's exactly right. He did the gospel according to Phil Collins.
Okay.
And so it was nice too, because you have a lot of authors and pastors and writers and academic people, you know, doing these sessions. So Zach was, I think, the only kind of artist, you know.
For people who don't know, Zach is the drummer for the band Jimmy Eat World.
Yeah, right. Yep. And so that was a really neat change from everything that we had heard. So he kind of talked about creativity and his later here in life discovery of and fascination with Phil Collins. He told the story. He was just driving down the road with his kids and heard a Phil Collins tune come on, and somehow it hit him and impacted him. And so he just kind of got into Phil Collins. And has he talked to you much about that experience?
No, I've never talked to him about the Phil Collins. I've always wanted to ask him about it. I probably should just ask him about it, honestly.
Yeah. Well, you should ask him about a talk, and so I won't give too much of it away. But you know, I think Phil Collins hit him a couple of years ago, and for whatever reason, he went back home and started kind of getting into his music and exploring it. And one of his take-home points is that at least in his world, kind of the alternative rock world, anything that was mainstream or pop was considered to be a bit of a sellout.
Yeah.
So he had faced some sort of criticism that, you know, that he had gotten into this kind of, you know, 80s, 90s pop star. And one of his points was, don't let anybody make you feel guilty for what you like, and especially if you're trying to do something creative, because they're going to rob you of your creativity. And so like what you like. And if you like Phil Collins, aggressively like Phil Collins, you know. I mean, don't let anybody shame you out of your, you know, what gives you, you know, what moves you emotionally.
Did that make you feel guilty after you cut your hair? You're like, you know, I really like my hair and I feel shamed into cutting it. Was there some conviction?
No. My hair wasn't, you know, that's funny.
Okay. All right. I'm just asking. We're friends here. I just want you to be able to be comfortable with who you are.
I wasn't shamed into it.
Okay.
You know?
Okay. We don't have to talk about it anymore. I get what you're saying. All right. There's boundaries here. You posted a video of a gentleman. I don't know if I'm going to get his name pronounced correctly, but I think it's Dieter Zander.
Yeah.
That was out there. And I'd heard his story before, and I don't know where I've heard it, but he was a very successful worship leader, pastor, kind of on the celebrity Christianity thing. And he had this stroke and lost his ability to use the gift that he had been given. And he goes from being on the stage, making six figures, having a very prominent presence, to now working, I think it's at a Trader Joe's. Is that right?
Yeah. He does janitorial work for a Trader Joe's.
Yeah. You posted a video about that, and it was just very, very powerful. Was that story told there? Or how did you get connected with that?
Yeah, he was one of the speakers.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, he was one of the speakers. So he got up, and one of the effects of his stroke is it affected his right hand. He played the piano, I believe.
Okay.
And so obviously that kind of robbed him of his ability to play the piano and be a worship minister. So that's all taken away from him. But the other thing was aphasia, which is, if you don't know what aphasia is, listeners in the world, it's a language loss. And so his ability to kind of form words and speak very fluidly is greatly affected. So in many ways, he's kind of trapped in his own head. He can't get the words out. So his ability to speak, you know, and preach was obviously affected as well. But he did speak, and he can, his speech is kind of fragmented, but the ideas come through very clearly. And it was, so him telling that story is kind of the story of this descent into kind of anonymity You know, so he finds himself on the stage under the spotlight with all his talent, and now he's in the back room of a Trader Joe's sorting through spoiled food for the homeless and mopping floors. And it's, so it's a story you think, it's, you know, from the outside world, you look like a tragic story, but he describes how he's found God in this anonymous location of service. And it's just, it was just the, one of the most beautiful things I had ever heard. And he had written down his experience, and it was kind of set to poetry by a woman that he knew, and they put it to that video, and it was it just blew me away. That was probably the highlight. I think, yeah, if anybody went to the conference, that was the highlight. Like,
really?
That was the gospel. Yeah, that was the gospel right there.
Yeah, I can see that. So, as you know, my mom's been, you know, sick basically for as long as I can remember. And, you know, one of the things that, you know, she said as a, you know, chronically ill person is that sometimes people don't want to be around chronically ill people because it reminds them of their own mortality and their own finitude. And there's something about that guy's story where obviously I don't pretend to think that I am wherever he was, but it reminds me that the things that I have they can be gone so quickly, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And there's something really powerful. I guess it's terrifying, isn't it? I mean, this might be some of your slavery of death stuff that, like, we don't want to be reminded of our own mortality. What's the line?
Mm-hmm.
You had someone quote something about, like, we know the guy next to us is going to die, but maybe not us. There's something like we get that it happens conceptually, but not like me. And maybe I guess that story is so powerful because, like, this, to a lot of people, that's like the worst case scenario. Like that could happen to anyone. And
yeah.
you have someone who's been positive and been able to make peace with it. I think that's what's so overwhelming about it.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I think we achieve, you know, connecting this back with my book, The Slavery of Death. You know, so much of our identities and our sense of significance and living a meaningful life is all tied up in our ability to perform or to be successful. And so, yeah, when you're encountered with the possibility that you would be unable to make your life matter in the way you think it does, like in his life, Peter's life, and it's robbed from you. So then what makes your life significant if you're a janitor?
Yeah.
or you know, and that, so that's one of the big points in The Slavery of Death, is that when Jesus asks us to voluntarily, so Dieter experiences this through a stroke, mm-hmm. when Jesus asks us to voluntarily take the last place, to be the servant of all, that just creates a lot of anxiety in us about we can't do it, because we crave being in the limelight. You know, what makes us matter is our talent, our, you know, in his case, our speaking ability, our ability to play, you know, instrument. So I guess Brene Brown calls it the shame-based fear of being ordinary. We can't be an ordinary person. And so we run into that shame all the time. And so we can't follow Jesus because we're always trying to put ourselves into the first place rather than the last place. And it was an amazing story.
Yeah, definitely. I think he's at Virginia, but Jonathan Haidt, is that how you say his name? I know you're
familiar. Yeah, I think it's Jonathan Haidt. Yeah, Haidt. Mm-hmm.
I think it was in one of his books, maybe the Happiness Hypothesis, where he talked about some of the research that's connected people who win the lottery and people who become paraplegic. Their happiness rates within a year, both of them return back to where they were before those incidents happened. And so he says,
yeah.
You know, after a year, the lottery winner, obviously it's very exciting, and then eventually it kind of fades off and becomes your new normal. And the same thing with a paraplegic is that, you know, after the accident happens, obviously it's very tough, but eventually it kind of like returns to like this average baseline happiness that you had before. And you know, seeing someone's story like that, I can't imagine it, but I see it. I mean, that's an example. Every Sunday at church, you know, we gather on the table with a friend of mine who, when he was my age, you know, was diagnosed with MS, and now when we gather around the table, someone literally has to pour the cup in his mouth because he doesn't have the ability to do that anymore. And he has a grateful disposition. He's positive, and he's a reminder of this is the good news that we have, is that there is an ability to find peace in that. And so those stories, like, I know that conceptually, but there's still part of me that I just could not imagine how you find peace after that.
Yeah. you feel a great deal of loss, I think. And so, on the good side, like you said, it's an amazing story of how humans can be so resilient. You know,
definitely.
People can face chronic illness, you know. But on the positive side, on the successful side, psychologists call it the hedonic treadmill, that you get on this treadmill to kind of become happier and happier, but you just habituate back to your default state of, you know, wherever you were before.
What did you call that?
The hedonic treadmill, like hedonism.
Oh,
so the
okay.
Hedonic treadmill is where we're chasing after pleasure, we're chasing after happiness. But we're not moving forward because, like that research that you decided, you know, you get ahead for a little while, but then you drift back to your previous state, you know, wherever you were.
Yeah. Well,
achieving that deep state of happiness is the trick, I think.
Yeah.
You know, shifting that.
And all the research seems to point to the fact that it's all about gratitude. Like, that's where it centers back to. Like, if you learn to be grateful, that is ultimately, like, the secret to be happy. Is that fair? Fair statement?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think research in what's called positive psychology, people kind of searching happiness and well-being, that tends to be one of the just most durable traits of the happiest people in the world, that they just experience life as with thankfulness and gratitude. And what I love about that, I wrote about this on my blog a month or so ago, is how kind of St. Paul talks about gratitude. He says, you know, the whole world is made holy through being thankful. That's how the world is sanctified, through our Thanksgiving. And so, so gratitude has become huge for me as just trying to understand how we relate to life and loss.
Yeah,
it's easy to be grateful when things are going well, but that's the thing about Peter's story is the way he just experienced so much joy. The really distinctive thing he said, and so Tatiana was with me, my wife, which captured both of us, is how in this low place of his life, God comes to him and says, come play with me.
Wow.
And it was a really interesting phrase. I've never heard anybody say, come play with me, you know, but this kind of childlike delight of God asking us to play in the small anonymous encounters of the day in the life or whatever. And so that was the thing that really struck me about him, is that joy and gratitude. Even with, you know, ostensibly how much he lost, that really came through.
Yeah.
You said that infectious joy.
Yeah. You said that you know, gratitude has become a big deal to you. Are there certain ways that you practice Thanksgiving or gratitude? Any like spiritual disciplines that help you live into that more?
Well, I hesitate to say this because this is going to sound so damn religious. What I'm about to say. prayer and worship and singing singing for me.
Really? Singing?
Yeah, well, here's what happened to me. So I started leading this prison Bible study on Monday nights, and it's like 2 hours. We got to fill all of this 2-hour time with the guys, and it's just a lot, you know, that's a lot of time to talk about the Bible. And
yeah.
So I just felt like we needed to do something else, but there wasn't a whole lot to do. But they had all of these hymnals on the shelf. And I asked the guys, like, you know any of those songs? And I said, not many, you know, because they weren't raised in the church or anything like that somewhere. And I said, my goodness, I'm from the Church of Christ. I know all the songs in my book. And so we started, I started handing them out. And so halfway through the 2 hours, we pull out the hymnals and we just kind of do an old hymn thing. They call out numbers of songs and I sing.
Seriously? Are you
standing up
and you doing like the hand thing where you, you know, go to the different beats or whatever you do with your hand when you're a worship leader?
I don't beat time. I feel somewhat self-conscious on that. Yeah. Yeah. But it is like, it's like one of those, you know, it's an old hymn thing and we, you know, taught them songs and, you know, it's been, and those singing sessions with them on Monday nights in the depths of that, you know, maximum security prison has, in the way it affects them and lifts their spirits, has profoundly affected me. I've written about this, and I've talked a lot about that, but I think I talk about in the slavery of death toward the end. And so I think the difference is, for me, is these disciplines practiced on the margins, I think that's the thing that's helped me understand gratitude, to bring it back to that issue, is that when I sing, in church on Sunday, I love singing at my church, but it always kind of left me cold. But like inside, singing inside of prison, where like life is very desperate and brutal, and people need a little ray of hope, that these songs of sung inside of prison sound very, very different, because they are literally life-saving. In a similar way, singing and worshiping with Freedom Fellowship. So that's a little church plant on the south side of town that reaches out to poor and homeless people. And that's where I worship on Wednesday nights. And singing with them, and that community has a little bit of a charismatic feel to it. So like they sway in the aisles and dance and raise their hands. And I'm a very rational, unemotional person. And so it's taken me a while to kind of understand what's going on there, but the way they're transformed in worship, and you can see them being seen by God. They get their self-esteem is affected by the way they see seen by God in worship. And so again, it's just another example of when you're worshiping on the margins, you kind of understand singing a little bit more. It's just not this, it's not this routine kind of thing. And the same way with prayer. Prayer has been for me more than anything, not a petitionary thing, but an act of opening oneself up to just try and be grateful for the world. So again, Anne Lamott said, right, what are their three words of prayer? Prayer is like help, wow, and thank you.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
The thank you part. And I know prayer and worship seem very religious things to say, but I've been trying to live into those practices more and more not necessarily to kind of like do it in a pietistic way, but to try to cultivate a sense of just thankfulness for everything.
You said that in the prison, there's a real need for hope, and there's not as much need for hope in a church service typically. Is there a way that we, as like the normal churchgoers, show up every Sunday morning and can actually connect to that need for hope more? Is there like a way that we can be more aware of our need for hope, or are we just too domesticated and too content to really need that?
Yeah. I think a lot of it has to be part of the pushback that I would get myself on what you just said is that it's easy to talk about the prison or talk about the poor and then go into like your suburban, mainly white, affluent church service and say, look at all these privileged people. But I think part of the problem with those church services is not that there aren't people in there that are desperately, because there are a lot of desperate people. And I'm like, God loves white people too, and so he loves the middle class and the wealthy too. You know what I'm saying? I mean, those people are hurting too. I think that the trouble comes is that for some of us that are well off, we're back to that kind of shame-based fear of being ordinary. We're not showing our need. We're not showing our vulnerability and our failure and our brokenness. And so as you worship in those settings, it comes off as worshiping with people who don't really need it. Anything. And so I do think if we were more vulnerable and realize how desperate our situations were and we're able to share those, then we can worship beside each other, because the person worshiping next to me isn't, a well-dressed, affluent white person, but is somebody that like is experiencing a divorce or domestic violence or a prescription drug addiction. Suddenly their need is, I see their need. And so then when I sing along with her, the worship becomes again a little bit more vital and life-saving and matters more. But when we hide from each other, it's easy to just kind of go into church and go, here all these people got their acts together, sing some songs, let's do a good sermon, and we all leave. And you don't feel like you really connected at a deep level. So I think if we were more authentic and transparent, then what I'm describing at the prison and at Freedom would happen in every church.
Hmm. Yeah, but I really like just walking in and getting my coffee and donuts and just saying, I'm having a good day. How are you? And that seems a whole lot more comfortable than like sharing stuff. Like that sounds really awkward.
Yeah.
Okay, before I feel like I have to like be honest with you, let's change the subject.
Okay.
So a few weeks ago, got a talk with Donald Miller. Donald Miller, everyone knows him, Blue Like Jazz. His new book is called Scary Close. Look at me. I'm remembering book titles. I'm growing as a person. It's really impressive. Okay. And so you remember, I guess it was probably a year or two ago, he wrote a blog post about not going to church. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I did.
Okay.
It blew up on the internet.
It blew up. And then he had to do a follow-up, and it blew up. And he wrote about it in his book. And so I felt like, okay, well, I can talk to you about it. And I didn't have a whole lot of time with him, and it wasn't in person. So it's not like I really can have a I felt like I could really engage a very difficult subject in the way that it probably deserved. But I was curious to talk about it with you, not so much from like the Donald Miller specific incident as much as like the bigger question, the bigger issue of how do we respond to people when we disagree with them? Because there are some people, and I had one person I know in particular say, you know, since Donald Miller said he's quote unquote graduated from church, which I'm not sure if he actually said that or not. He might have, I don't know. But since Donald Miller's graduated from church, then I'm not going to buy any more of his books. I'm not going to go to his events, and I'm done with him. And so it's kind of like that, you know, the farewell Rob Bell, farewell Donald Miller. Like we do something, and it's out of balance, and so all of a sudden we're going to just like cut him off. And so from your perspective, what is behind that? Like as as people, what's causing us to do that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a huge question. Some of it I think is tied up with our ambivalent relationship with celebrities. They become really meaningful to us. And so in the early days, we loved them. You know, like, remember the days when Donald Miller wrote Blue Like Jazz? You mean, like, everybody loves that Donald Miller, you know? And then, but as they get popular, there's something I think about. There's a kind of a degree of envy, and so the relationship becomes more contested and contentious. And then when they falter, there is a quick glee in, you know, pulling them back down. We liked them back when they just emerged because they made us feel hopeful for ourselves. Like if they made it, you know, and they, you know, it wasn't so long ago when they were struggling just like we were. But then as time goes on, they become more successful. I think there's this kind of resentment that builds up. And so we start then, we then turn on them very quickly. And it's not just, you know, Christian celebrities, it's all sorts of celebrity. You know,
do you think that part of it is like at the beginning, say, oh, this is some guy who told some stories about a confessional booth outside of Reed College or, you know, some fun stories, but we only know like 200 words or 200 pages of him. We don't know a whole lot, but as you get five or six books and a blog that people have read, now we actually really get to know him. And at the beginning, it's more like this is what we want him to be because we don't really know exactly who he or she is after, you know, one book or, you know, 6 months in the spotlight.
Yeah. No, I think, I agree. I think it's when the humanity of the person is eventually revealed, we're disillusioned. So there is that sense of disillusionment with this person that we thought was going to be the next. I think maybe we continue to keep looking for kind of like messiah figures that we keep projecting onto, you know, this is going to be the person that's going to be the one that will really kind of get it all fixed.
And that's what we're asking for with our celebrities is that they're going to be really messiahs for us.
Well, I think so. I mean, what we call it hero worship and idol worship. I mean, there is a sort of worshipful kind of aspect about it. They kind of represent demigods, right? They kind of, we put kind of transcendent values onto them, or hopes or dreams or whatever. And then when they falter and we realize they're just, you know, they have problems just like us, or they have opinions that we disagree with. And
they get their hair cut when we don't want them to. That kind of stuff.
Yeah, I know. The fall from grace.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
So I get this question somewhat often, but people ask, so do you agree with everyone on your podcast? Like, do you agree with everything someone says? And I'm like, well, I've had like 80 or so people on the podcast. Like, can you get any 80 people that you know or don't know in a room and agree with them on everything? Like, there's no possible way you could do that. But some people I don't think are comfortable with being able to have conversations with someone who disagrees with you on an issue, which has varying degrees of importance. But I sense that we're just not comfortable with being able to converse with people who have different opinions on things. And like the Donald Miller one was about church. And obviously church is a very weighty subject for many of us, especially those of us who work at churches and get our bills paid by churches, that if they're going to disagree with us about that, it's like we can't even be friends with them.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking about this the other day. I worship in a church that I would describe as more conservative than myself. Mm-hmm. And so there's lots of people around me that probably have more conservative opinions than me. And some people express amazement that you know, you're in the Church of Christ, like you. Yeah. How does that work? And I don't know, there's a degree of, I don't know what the word would be, you have to have a tolerance for just the fact that people are going to say things and you're going to have a different perspective on that. But it doesn't somehow like emotionally trigger you in our, just like, you know, I almost assume everybody disagrees with me. Maybe it's because my whole life I've always had minority views, you know, on a variety of subjects. I just kind of assume that everybody disagrees with me. And so when people disagree with me, I'm not particularly alarmed or upset by it. I'm like, well, you know, of course people disagree with me.
So you're in some ways like expecting every Sunday you go to church, you hear a sermon and the preacher says some ridiculous comment and you're just, with your preacher, of course, that probably happens often, but you're just like,
my preacher, my gosh, the crazy things he's throwing down.
Oh, storm it. But okay. But you're fine with that. Other people will just like leave. I got a message from someone, just yesterday. You know, he posted something about his view, LGBTQ stuff. I hope I got all that right. And someone who goes to his church had a donor who supports this other guy's ministry, not the guy who wrote it, but a guy who goes to his church. And so he's upset, pulls his funding or wants to pull his funding from this guy's project because his preacher wrote something on a blog. And you're like, is there no room for any sort of disagreement on this? And you touched on this. You did a blog post about being biblical means be biblically tolerant. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so like everyone says, we're just like the Bible people, sola scripture. That's what we have. But even people who quote that do not agree on everything. And so how do we get to the point where like I care about the Bible, but that doesn't mean my opinion on the Bible is therefore the Bible itself? Like, how do you get to the point where you're okay with disagreement in church? Because most of us can't get there.
Yeah. I think a lot, you know, I think ultimately you got to get to a point where you hold, there's issues with what I'm about to say, but you want to get to the point where you kind of hold ideas more lightly. And I want to be clear, like ideas matter, particularly ideas that can hurt other people. So I want to be clear about that. But at some point, you just got to say that the doctrines and the theologies are just less important than the behaviors. And so I think one of the reasons why I tolerate my conservative brothers and sisters is because I've known them by being raised in a conservative church to be some of the most loving and gracious people that I know. And they, even though I might disagree with them on an opinion, that when push comes to the shove, they're the people that will often behave in the most loving ways. And so when I see that, it chastens any sort of doctrinal disagreement because I kind of see the witness of their lives. Huh. And some of this, to give another example from the prison, right? So, you know, at the prison where I work, most of the chaplains, volunteers out there are coming from very conservative fundamentalist perspectives. And so we probably disagree a great deal on things like hell and all sorts of things. But they're out there, you know, at the prison. And there's a lot of other liberal, progressive Christians that I know in my town who I would probably agree with A to Z on doctrine, on you know, penal substitution or atonement and all those kinds of things. But they're not over at Freedom Fellowship eating with homeless people, and they're not over at the prison visiting prisoners. I mean, does it make sense? And so at some point you just kind of go, oh, okay, you know, we're just going to disagree with some stuff. They might vote differently from me, and they might have very different conservative views on scripture, but, you know, they're helping me wash dishes on Wednesday night, and they're sitting with me in this Bible study with prisoners. And so you got the common work has to bind you together. But I think the reason, to come back to your point, the reason I think why these ideas have become so volatile is that they become identity markers now. Certain belief systems kind of mark in group and out group now. And so therefore, heresy in different ideological positions becomes. So I think, again, we're using our ideas and our belief systems to kind of carve out an identity for ourselves, a religious identity, you know, the holy like-minded.
And so we have this subset of beliefs that make us like the elect. We're the good ones because we think this.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think coming back to like, think about a book like Unclean, there's a purity impulse there. So to have this kind of pure in-group ideologically, be it liberal or progressive, conservative, you maintain purity through scapegoating. You know, you got to expel the people who don't hold to that. And so it's an ideological purity. And so I think you see that. I think a lot of people are struggling with that now on the progressive side. You see a lot of people kind of wrestle with the kind of reemergence of political correctness on the left. And how we're continually ganging up on people on social media if they express an opinion or don't use the language in the proper way. Like, you even did that. Like, you just made a joke about one night that LGBTQ correct, right?
Yeah.
The idea there is this: if you make an error there,
someone's going to get you.
Then you get mobbed, you know, as being one of those people that support.
Yeah.
But it's just a liberal version of what Piper did to Rob Bell. You know, it's still a farewelling. It's still an expulsion from the pure in group. And so there's a sense where liberals kind of cannibalize themselves by you know, expelling each other, you know, as not they're not a good enough ally. You know, they faltered in their mistakes. They're not doing it well. They're still centering themselves by. You see that struggle on the left.
Yeah,
I think on the right, it's a little different. They tend to circle the wagons, yeah. They have more of a group. They kind of, you know, have more in-group kind of loyalty kinds of things, and so they'll group circle the wagons.
Why do you think they have more in-group loyalty than liberals do?
Well, to come back to Jonathan Haidt's work, I think that's just one of the values of the conservative moral.
Yeah.
You know, he talks about these different moral grammars. And one of the moral grammars that conservatives have is just in-group loyalty. And so if you are part of the tribe, you're in, even if you're, you know, even if you're a little crazy. And I think that's the danger, because what happened in the conservative movement is when you see somebody actually behaving in a damaging way, so you see something like a sexual abuse scandal or something emerge, you know, they will tend to hide that because they want to protect the group. You know, and so there's kind of like, we circle the wagons, we protect our own, even if that means silencing victims. So that's the temptation on the
right.
On the right.
Yeah, and that's the stuff.
Go ahead. Well, and then on the left, I think what you see is a one-upmanship on out. You try to out radicalize. Hmm. You know what I mean? Everybody. And so what happens on the left is kind of that ramping up. So you're trying to achieve a degree of purity. You're trying to show that you're less and less complicit or less and less, or more and more in solidarity with the poor or the marginalized or those kinds of things. And so that's so that you see kind of a one-upmanship there to be, but again, still a pursuit of moral purity in both cases.
It just looks different.
It looks different. So you're trying to be the righteous one in the debate, however that is defined.
That's really interesting. And obviously, the work you're referencing is from Haidt's book, The Righteous Mind. He has a lot of good stuff on that. So that's good. All right, let's change gears here. We're going to air this next Tuesday, which will be the day before Ash Wednesday. You grew up Catholic. That was your background, right?
Well, no, my mom was Catholic. Yeah, I went to parochial schools, and so I went from sixth grade all the way through high school. I went to Catholic schools, and so, you know, I went to a lot of Mass and had all my friends were Catholic and was taught by Catholic clergy and sisters.
Well, if you walk into Richard Beck's office, you basically feel like you're in a Catholic church. So I'm going to consider you Catholic.
It's funny. I every decor in my office, and like lots of people go, "Is Dr. Beck Catholic?" And it's pretty intense.
Yeah, that's. I'm kidding. I say that as I've got a rosary in my hand every time I do a podcast, so I can't really make fun of you. But you go to a Church of Christ church that I think in the last two or three years has implemented an Ash Wednesday service. And so I did a podcast last year with your coworker, Jeff Childers, church historian, and we did a little church history on Ash Wednesday. I might have gone back and listened to that as I was prepping for my Ash Wednesday service next week, but this will be airing the day before Ash Wednesday. And so let's talk a little bit about Ash Wednesday, because that seems to be a church service that would just tie right into a lot of your work, especially slavery to death stuff. Slavery to death, you know, a big thrust of that book is talking about how much we try to run away from and deal with our like basic survival fear, our fear of death. And Ash Wednesday seems to be the service, the holiday, the event that really embraces that. So you must just love Ash Wednesday.
I do love Ash Wednesday because of that. Yeah, there's something profound to have ashes imposed on your forehead with, you know, the words, from Dust You Are. Dust you are and dust you will return as a significant mortality reminder.
So tell us why it's important for us to have this mortality reminder, because often we don't want to deal with that. When our hair starts to thin, we cut it off so we don't have to deal with our mortality. When you post videos by our friend Dieter Zander, we want to skip right past that because that reminds us that could happen to us any given day. Like, why do we need to go against that impulse to run away from those things?
Well, I think two things. One is idolatry. I think one of the fascinating things I think about the book of Ecclesiastes is when I read Ecclesiastes, I read it as a book about, it's kind of an anti-idolatry book. All of these human strivings and you know, the chasing the wind. Usually in the prophetic literature, idolatry is always is described as kind of unfaithfulness. You know, don't be an idolater because you're going to be unfaithful and God will judge you. So God's going to drop this hammer on you for being an idolater, and you're going to go into exile. But I think the wisdom literature does it a little differently. It's still anti-idolatry, this striving, this pushing. But it uses death as an acid to kind of erode the human ego. You know, all the way through Ecclesiastes, you're gonna all this stuff is built on sand. It's transient. And so vanity or meaninglessness, as it's translated, is a Hebrew word, hevel or hebel, which just means mist. And so life is mist, and this trying to cling or grasp to build or gain is critiqued. And so I think there's something about death that chastens the idolatry. And so I do think you've got to confront your death, because it makes you look at, like, hey, all this stuff I'm pursuing, you know, for me, like a blog, let's say, like all of these blog stats and all of this, I'm trying to be something, and death comes in with Ash Wednesday and Ecclesiastes and say, come on, you know, this is all mist. It's all castles made of sand. And so I do think there's something about mortality that is an anti-idolatry you gotta read. So, which is why Ecclesiastes says, right, it's better, there's more wisdom going to a funeral than going to parties. Huh. Because there's a perspective there. And so I think that's one part.
Okay.
I think the idolatry part, death as another way of coming at our idolatry. Because you could do that, right? And I think that's a better way to preach to this world. Like, I think if you went out there and trying to, like, critique idolatry in American society, you could do it like the Hebrew prophets and say, you know, God's going to send you to hell, you know, you sinners. Or you could do it the way Ecclesiastes does and say, hey, you're going to chase all these blue ribbons, you're going to attain all these accolades, but, you know, we're all heading back to dust.
Yeah.
And it puts things in perspective there.
Well, that's kind of depressing, though.
It is, but
all the stuff you work for, it doesn't matter. Right?
Well, but in the midst of Ecclesiastes, though, are these beautiful odes to work and food and drink and friendship.
Yeah.
And so you use death, and this is where you can get your dad back on the podcast. As existentially oriented psychologists will use death to force us back into the day. It's very common in existential psychotherapy to kind of have people come in and, you know, think about their obituaries and think about, like, their funeral. Like, what do you want people to say about you?
Yeah.
So there is something, there is a way we use death. Yeah, it is depressing. And so yeah, you can't, you know, there is Easter.
Yeah, but as a preacher, when I talk about death, I'm supposed to use that to motivate people to make a response, to come forward, to cry, and to get baptized. Like, that's my job as a preacher. But you're not saying don't do that. You're saying let that give more meaning to what you're doing by understanding its finitude.
Yeah. I think death helps give the present moment weight and depth, which it forces us into. If you realize, so I think in the wisdom literature, right, I think it's in the Psalms, says, you know, teach us to number our days that we might learn a heart of, you know, gain a heart of wisdom. And so wisdom is this kind of sense that I got to number each day. I only have so many pebbles. So each day is a pebble. I've been given so many. And I number each one of them. I mark them well. And so the idea of pushing us deeper into the today. Otherwise, here's the thing. If you live like a god, little g, like a demigod, like an immortal, like somebody who cannot die, like you got all the time in the world, what ends up happening is you waste time. You know, you watch too much TV or serve a little way. You don't go, like, what really matters right now? You know, so use biblical language, right? You're trying to live as an eschatological person. You're trying to live with the end in mind. Living as an apocalyptic person. The end is breaking into today. Eternity is right now.
Yeah.
So that kind of conflation of times. So rather than kind of seeing, I think some of us kind of see time serially, like I'm living forward and then I die and then I'll live forever. And I think what the Bible's trying to do is kind of get to try to stack times.
Stack times.
Stacking time. So eternity is sitting on top of or sitting beneath this current moment. So I'm going deeper into time rather than
That's
looking
forward. That's pretty deep right there. Stacking time.
Stacking time.
Did you come up with that?
Just right now.
I don't know what it means, to be honest with you, but it sounds awesome. I feel like I'm in Inception right now.
Well, some of that I'm borrowing from lots of people. Like, I think N.T. Wright's stuff is really good on this topic.
And, I remember my friend Tom talked about that once. Yeah.
Yeah. Brother Tom. John called him Brother Tom. But I also got that from William Stringfellow. That's a really big William Stringfellow insight.
Okay. So Ash Wednesday reminds us of the idolatry.
Say, the other thing I would say, though, is going back to your point about and this is something I point to make in Unclean, is that it's only when we recognize our own vulnerability and susceptibility to loss and death and decay and damage that we become empathic people. Hmm. So when we see failure in others, unemployment or physical disability or chronic illness, to come back to your mom, right? If I'm not reminded you know, about my own susceptibility to those states, then my heart, it can come kind of calloused toward that. So I think a reminding of this annual reminder of our own physicality, which means our own susceptibility to decay and damage and, disability and disease and dementia and all these different kinds of things. So unless I'm reminded of those things, then I can again become kind of insulated and, begin to live like in a godlike kind of way, like it can't happen to me.
Yeah.
And what happens then is then we moralize the failure. Like when we see the failure in other people, we instead of seeing that as just a natural human condition, and my heart goes out to it, I see that as some sort of moral failing on their part. Like, you know, they're bad people because they've got themselves that situation or whatever. And so this is I talk about this unclean by the story in Matthew 12, where there's a man with a withered hand, and so he's like got a physical deformity, and Jesus says, "Is it law?" You know, he asks, "Is it okay to heal on the Sabbath?" And he heals him, and they get all upset. But then he tells that story. He says, "But how many of you, if your sheep fell into the ditch, wouldn't go right after it?" And that's that. Image of the sheep going in the ditch is not like, it's not like a pet. It's not like Fluffy the sheep going into the ditch and they have affection for Fluffy. I mean, it's an economic illustration. He's saying, you guys are just as vulnerable. If something happened to you on the Sabbath, you'd want somebody to help you. But because you can't see your own vulnerability, you can't see how your sheep can fall into the ditch. You can't see how you might be unemployed or you might have a child with a catastrophic illness and you don't have any insurance because you can't see those medical bills or the job loss or the chronic illness in your family. You lack your ability to empathize with the unemployed or people without insurance or an immigrant. You mean you can't see your own vulnerability. And so I think all I have to say is I think Ash Wednesday, as a reminder of our mortal vulnerability, is also important for cultivating empathy for human frailty and vulnerability.
Yeah. That's good. That's good.
Yeah.
Okay. I got a couple quick things we got to touch on. We're running out of time, but we got to touch on these. Okay.
Okay. Quick.
First of all, you did a blog post about the laundromat just a couple of days ago. That it was like, brilliant insight. A great blog post. Everyone needs to read it. Talk about your wife going to a laundromat. You find this is, what was it, the third space? Is that the language you use? People talk about coffee shops, but you say, let's go to laundromats. And that is, it's a brilliant blog post. But here's the problem. You make us feel guilty because we don't do that kind of stuff. And what's supposed to happen is you should like link to like some Shane Claiborne book about that we buy it. We read like the first chapter, highlight a few things, and then we put it on our shelf, and then we don't have to deal with the poor.
That's right.
But you're trying to like actually like do life together, and that's kind of uncomfortable. So can we kind of like have a warning before those kind of blog posts or something that we can?
I'll put a warning up there. Thanks. This is
Luke. Skip this one.
I didn't know. I didn't know. I mean, I didn't know that post was going to go as viral as it did. I mean, that was like one of the most viral things that I ever posted.
Are you
like,
serious?
It's crazy. It's still going crazy today.
And it should. I mean, it's powerful stuff right there. Okay.
Yeah, I think one of the big things about that is how we often like create these funky third spaces, but they're kind of spaces that we like and that we frequent. So we all like coffee shops, and so let's make a coffee shop. But if you've never been to a laundromat, you don't realize, that's a space where the neighborhood hangs out as well. So
is there a way you can
kind of reveal certain privileges that we have?
What if you're a germaphobe? Is there a way that you can engage with that? Maybe just like,
hey, that's a whole other conversation, because I have a lot of germaphobic kinds of things. And
really?
So when I have, I wrote about this a long time ago on my blog about, I think I call it the sensory boundary, that when you're really kind of living out on the margins, there's a variety of sensory OCD triggers that you got to get over. And like, I remember taking some friends, you know, home, and they're just chatting casually in the car, and they're like, yeah, we had the, we had to get the people to come in and take care of our bed bugs. I'm thinking, oh my gosh, there's gonna be bed bugs in my car, and then I'm gonna take it in, and then there's gonna be bed bugs in our bed with Jana, and she's gonna like, you know, there's a limit to your solidarity with the poor.
Exactly. That's biblical.
When bed bugs come into my house, that's the line.
Yeah.
But you gotta get over these kinds of. I'm a germaphobe too, and so, but boy, there's a sort of self overcoming that has to take place.
I think Jesus said, you know, foxes have nests and holes, but the Son of Man doesn't have beds, bugs. So I think that's biblical. I'm fine with that.
Yeah.
I completely sign off on that. Okay. Next one. You wrote a thank you post a while ago talking about how you felt marginalized, isolated, and then you create this community around your blog. Your blog becomes this community. And you wrote this nice, you know, note saying thank you to all the people who read and have helped create this community. And that was a really genuine, it was a very nice thing you did. So you're welcome. You said thank you to me. I'm saying you're welcome back to you. My question is this. When you're writing this, what's the song in the back of your head? Because the song that I hear in, you know, coming through your words is I felt like you were writing that blog post with Celine Dion's Because You Love Me. That's the song that I had in my head. Is that true? Is that right or wrong?
That's right. That
was it. That's what I felt like you were singing to me.
Yeah, it was beautiful. You know what's funny? I have a sentimental streak. I don't know if it comes out in my writing, but like I'm a really sentimental person, and that post kind of let it come out a little bit. I don't know. I was feeling.
Did you tear up a little bit when you wrote that?
I tear up all the time.
I think
there's something about getting older. Thinking of my hair falling out is, you know, I tear up a lot more.
Yeah.
I don't know why that is.
I dropped my oldest daughter off at school, and she was walking down the hill, and I was just watching her, and I might have started to cry. And I was like, you do this every day, Luke. What is wrong with you? And I don't know. Maybe it's early onset ageism, like you're speaking of. I'm getting old at a young age. Okay, you wrote something about how you have a platform because of your blog that even some preachers don't have. You don't have to get a publisher. You don't have an invitation to speak at a conference. You don't have to have a podium to get up in to preach. But you have this platform now. And I was wondering, do you think there are any preachers? Have you ever like got any kind of, hey, what are you doing on our turf? You're a psychologist. You stay over there and talk about statistics. You let us do theology. Have you ever gotten any of that?
I don't think anybody is going to go up to me and say that to me directly. And so anything I've gotten would be more of a vibe. But when you're talking about vibes, that could just be my paranoia.
Your paranoia has kicked in. It said that there's some vibe going on. You felt that though, right?
Well, I don't think I felt it from preachers. I don't think preachers have been uniformly really happy, because I think one of the things I wanted to do is write for the church, and that means obviously writing for preachers. And a lot of preachers will say like I've used your stuff or I've quoted it or inspired me to think about something or whatever. And to me that is like one of the greatest encouragements. Like, you know, I just I think that's great. I think preaching's hard, and as America shifts in its religiosity, it's getting tougher and tougher. And so anything I can do to encourage preachers. And so they generally have reciprocated and said, thank you so much. And so always have that. I think mainly I've felt the vibe in academic settings. But where as it's not necessarily me speaking to the church, because I think most preachers want their members to have opinions and contribute. But I think it's whether or not I am qualified to be a theologian. Huh. You know what I mean? Or weighing on biblical texts. So if I've ever felt that it's been in the academy, that I'm encroaching on those kinds of territories where I'm unqualified to do that. And so if I've ever gotten involved, it's been more about that, like, is Richard a theologian or not?
Yeah.
And I've always tried to deny the label. Like, I'm not. I'm just a psychologist. I like theology. I think everybody has to do theology to make sense of their faith. I'm a lay theologian, I'll say, you know, so what's been nice is when I've encountered scholars who have read my stuff and they said, no, I think you're doing good work. I mean, that's good theology there, you know, like, so, like when I presented with Walter Brueggemann a few years ago, up at Rochester College at Streaming, you know, and he was complimentary of, you know, how
that must have felt good.
Yeah. It's just validated. And it's not that it's really risky work to try to write about theology when it's not your area of expertise, because you can make rude of entry mistakes very easily. My great fear is to kind of weigh in with some sort of authoritative tone, and somebody kind of raise their hand and go, you know, Augustine dealt with this on page 40 of the City of God, if you would have read it, you know. And I'm like, who has time to read the City of God? It's huge. I can't read it all, you know. But, you know, that kind of rudimentary rookie mistake that you know, you make a sweeping generalization, you're cut down. You know, those are the risks you have to take. And you have to risk, you know, you have to stay a student. You have to say, okay, that's a mistake. I'll learn. Thank you for that clarification and try to be better.
Thank you, sir. May I have another? Yeah. Rudimentary mistakes. That's just another code word for my sermons every Sunday. So I don't feel bad about that. Okay. Now, I hate to be encouraging and kind of break character and be nice for a second, but honestly, I really love your stuff. And as a preacher, I'm glad you're doing it. And I almost feel bad being this nice, but true story. When I was thinking about starting the podcast, I was reading The Authenticity of Faith, which is one of my favorite books. And I thought, I really need an excuse to go through this with Richard. I'd really like to talk to him about this. And I could do a podcast, and that'd be a really good excuse to do it. So when people say, why'd you start the podcast? I often say the book, The Authenticity of Faith.
So, oh, really?
As a preacher, I'm appreciative of your work.
Thanks.
Now let's go back and talk about your hair some more. I'm going to label this episode the haircut. That's what it's going to be titled.
The haircut episode.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I should send you, you know, because of Zach, I got to meet Ron Bell.
Oh, I saw a picture of that. Yeah. How was that?
Yeah. And so I should forward you that picture, because that's a good picture of my short hair.
I think Zach posted it on Facebook, and I think I saw it.
Yeah, you did. Yeah, Zach did, you know. And I got to give props to Zach, because Zach is one of the most unpretentious and just open-hearted guys. And he has, you know, he's always pushed my work in other people's hands. And he's the one that gave Rob Unclean to read, you know? And
oh, really?
But it's because of Zach. And so I was Zach. I mean, if anybody's ever heard of Richard Beck, it's probably because Zach Lynn told him, you know, told him about it. So I was Zach a lot.
My daughter, I don't really know how the iPads work that well, but some of my songs end up on her iPad, which is not always a good thing. But one of Zach's, you know, Jimmy Eat World songs is on there, and it came on like in between Taylor Swift and Frozen, and she goes, "That's my jam." I was like, "What? Yeah, that's my jam." All right, well, she likes Jimmy Eat World, so good for her. Hey, well, Richard, thanks for your time. We've gone over the hour mark. This is a long one. This is actually surpassing the N.T. Wright episode. As this might be the longest episode ever. And side note, thank you for your help with the N.T. Wright interview. You gave me an hour of your time to help me prep for that, and it is greatly appreciated.
Oh, yeah. Hey, anytime, right, buddy.
Thanks, Richard.
Pleasure.
Thanks for checking out Newsworthy with Norsworthy. Make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. You are now adjourned.